Today, moving on with your ballot information on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy, Barry Sheets. And along with me today is my co-host and Vice Chairman of the Policy Institute, Chuck Michaelis.
Well, I'm hoping we are able to fit it all into today because it got a little exciting yesterday.
Well, you know, yesterday we started talking about the statewide issues that are going to be facing you on the ballot when you go to the polls on November the 8th. And I do hope, Chuck, that all of our listeners that are hearing us today are registered to vote and do plan on going to vote on November the 8th, because that's how we keep our liberties, is by being engaged citizens.
A very important thing. Register and vote.
Okay. We started talking about, starting right down the list, we have three statewide issues that you're going to be dealing with on the ballot this year. And we started talking about state issue one, which would increase the maximum retirement age for judges in the state, along with a couple of other issues, which we kind of got into in more depth than I expected we would yesterday. But really what we get down to is, last time Ohio addressed judicial age limitations was in 1968. So it's been over 40 years since we've done this. And the argument is, oh, our quality of life's better, people are living longer, so therefore we should expand it out farther. Oh, and by the way, judges are the only group of elected officials who have mandatory age requirements. I say that that's probably because there's a really good reason for that, because when a judge issues a ruling, it usually sticks. But when a legislator or a governor, if a governor makes an executive order or a legislature issues a law, then a future legislature can say, hey, they were kind of doddering and senile, let's repeal that, and can do it fairly easily. But when a judge issues a ruling, it's hard to overturn a ruling because of the doctrine of
stare decisis,
which means let the decision stand. So I honestly, you know, Chuck, we started this yesterday. We were wrestling around, and I think both of us were kind of at the point of, we're not sure how this goes. Sounds like it could be good. One of the arguments in favor of this, one of the official, because there were official arguments for and against, and if folks want to go to the Ohio Secretary of State's website, which is sos.state, the word state, .oh.us, and click on election information, you can pull up the state issue information for these three ballot
issues.
That's
right. The official language, the official arguments for, the official arguments against,
and the full text of what you're going to see on the ballot. So it's all there, ladies and gentlemen, including the full text of the law that actually brought it about. But, you know, that's one of the arguments. Oh, it's not going to raise any costs. And it's like, well, yeah, you're still going to pay the judges whether they have to step down after age 70 or after age 75. Point is, if there's legislation to increase the salaries of our judges, and this person's at 72, guess what? His salary will get increased, which means his retirement gets increased, which means it will increase the cost to the state.
So, yes, that's right.
So I'm not sure that that's a really good argument. Now, a couple of the arguments against issue one, they talked about the fact that, you know, really, hey, our age limits prevent the bench from being held for decades by an entrenched judiciary. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not sure that's a really good argument either, because we have an elected judiciary. Every 6 years, we get the chance of overturning one or two at a time of our seven justices. I think it's like 1-2, 1-2-1 is how. So two, that's seven. So I like over a 5 year, over a 5 year period, we can totally overturn the bench, so that on year six, you've got nobody with more than 5 years of experience sitting on the bench, if you so choose to, as citizens, to elect or unelect those sitting justices.
Practically speaking, though, that's probably a rarity.
Probably a rarity. Yes, we'll give you that. But every once in a while, we have justices who, because of certain issues, they do things like, oh, I remember one state Supreme Court justice getting into a fist fight in his office with one of the other justices. And both of these men, I think, were getting close to the maximum retirement age of 70. Honestly, I'm thinking that that's probably not the best. I don't think that the pro issue one folks are going to be running any ads with either one of those justices.
No.
But the antis might. But when we gets right down here, is we're not saying, it's not like Logan's Run. You hit 70, you're dead. You know,
right? Soylent Green.
If you're in the middle of a term and you hit the age of 70, you can still serve out the rest of that term. So you can actually be on the bench until the age of 76. if you started your term and then hit 70 after it, it just means that you cannot stand for election again. Or if you were unelected, you can't be appointed to the seat knowing that you're going to hit that term. Now, I think that what we're saying is that Ohio's already got standards in place. And for the interest of the fact that because they're dealing with something so complex, I mean, we know legislators deal with complex issues, but with legislators, there's 132 of them that before a bill becomes a law in the state of Ohio, all of them get a say at it. All of them get a look at it. They get a bunch of attorneys to get a look at it. With the governor, you know, we've got staff who look at their decisions, things of that nature. But when we get to the Supreme Court, yes, they do have attorneys and there are law clerks, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, when it gets right down to it, you got seven people on our state Supreme Court who have to take a look at a complexity of issues, both federal and state issues involved in some cases, that can mean the difference between a person's life, his liberty, or his pursuit of happiness. And four votes determines whether it's an up or down. I think I want to have people who I can be confident with that they're going, the mental acuity of understanding the nuances of the law is still going to be sharp. Now, I'm not saying that you automatically, when you hit 75 years old,
right,
and it all goes south. But the point is that, you know, right now we have a situation where after 70, you can't run again. But even the Supreme Court allows that there's a pool that up to the age of 80, they can be assigned as special counsel. You know, when we have somebody sick or because of a conflict of interest, they can still be assigned to hear these cases if they are still active, as far as not
practicing law, or
they still have the law degrees, things of that nature.
Yeah.
I don't, honestly, I'm just going to say it right now, from my personal perspective, I don't believe this is a necessary change to our Ohio Constitution. And I don't necessarily like the idea of, even though the legislature saying they want us to take it away from them, of taking away the ability for our legislature to say, hey, you know what, the court's not doing this one right, we're going to create this other court of conciliation just for temporary time to handle this issue.
My thought on this so far has been that the current standards are set on a rationale that seemed to me to be fairly solid, and the reasons for changing those standards do not seem to be based on anything particularly new or compelling.
No, it doesn't seem to me. And you know, and I'm the type of person that I look at an issue and I try to think long term about, okay, where is this taking us to?
Right.
And the only place I can see that this issue is taking us to, where it doesn't look like it's moving the ball that far, is to getting rid of elected judges altogether, taking the people out of the equation, and making judges an appointment by the governor or by a special commission of the legislature, but basically making them appointees. Now, a number of other states have done that with mixed results at best. Here in Ohio, I think we have a good balance because we, the people, get to go and elect our judges. Now, we need to do a better job of educating ourselves about the judges and understanding how these judges view their decision-making process. Those are things that a number of groups work. They survey judges. You know, there are certain things you can't ask a judge because it deals with something that they're dealing with on the bench at the time.
It reveals a prejudice in favor, or it reveals a bias.
It reveals their biases.
Question.
That's
yeah.
Right. So we can't necessarily reveal their biases, but you can, if you get a number of these groups that all ask judges similar questions, you can start accumulating a body of information about the judge, and you can look at the cases that they've decided upon.
That's the real thing. You can look at their case history and determine that, in fact, they do have a bias. I mean, let's face it, everybody has a bias, but you can see what their bias is and what their worldview is by looking at their decisions.
That's right. And I know that there have been a couple of justices here recently who most people would have considered very conservative, whose recent rulings have really laid that to question mark, but I'm not going to discuss which justice that is because that's
right.
My own personal viewpoint on it.
That's not what we're here for.
But that's what we're here for. But what we are here for to say is we need to be cognizant of what we're doing. We need to be able to look at this issue and look at the long-term implications. Now, the long-term implications of taking away the people's right to vote on the judges who are going to be deciding the cases that is going to affect your and my well-being, maybe our businesses, maybe the way we raise our families, the way we can live in the state of Ohio. I mean, right now we have a court, we had a court that ruled that if an officer, a law officer assumes that you're speeding, you're guilty. you are speeding. Right. They don't have to prove the gun anymore.
Yeah, basically, if an officer comes in and testifies that in his opinion you were going 16 miles an hour over the speed limit, he gets to count that and write you a ticket at 16, and he has really no clue how fast you were going.
So I like the idea that if our judges start ruling that way, that we have a remedy. And that remedy is that we can take them off the bench in the elections.
Yeah. My real concern here is really most of the appointments in other states, the way they're done is through the Bar Association. And that means that essentially that it becomes a very crony style, who's popular, who isn't. You may have the most honest and decent lawyer in the county who has enemies because he's acted decently in his lawyering in that county, and the county bar association will give him a thumbs down because they don't want to have to deal with him on the bench.
Well, and that's where, you know, all the whole that whole adage, that old chestnut about all politics being local, well, it really is. Folks, you vote for your local judges. Get to know them, okay? Get to know the people who are in your county, in your city, who those judges are going to be, in municipal court, who are going to be. The judiciary is one area that most people who love liberty and are patriotic complain the most about, but know the least about, because we need to find these things out. But I think, honestly, right now, from my position, and I'm not sure from yours, and I'm not necessarily speaking for our institute.
That's right. This is you and me, not the Institute for Principal Policy.
Because we really do have to go before our board and figure this out. But honestly, I would say personally, I'm just going to say I'm going to vote no on State Issue 1 because I believe that our current system is doing just fine, thank you very much. And we shouldn't go about making changes to our state constitution willy-nilly, especially on areas that may be somewhat esoteric to begin with, because we need to understand the reasons why they were there in the first place. Because they may be reasons that we need again.
Right. Fixing things that aren't broken very often leads to broken things.
Isn't that the case? That's for sure. So, honestly, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I would say that issue one is probably one of the least polarizing issues on the ballot, but probably one of the most difficult to get your hands around. That's the reason why, for me personally, I'm going to probably be pulling the no lever on this, because at the end of the day, you're going to be asked the question when you get down to the bottom of the page when you read the ballot, and that says, shall the amendment be approved? Yes or no? And for me, I know where I'm going to be on that box. I'm going to be checking the no box.
So far, unless somebody comes up with a very compelling reason that convinces me that this simply wasn't cooked up to do so, whenever I see something like this that looks very pretty on its face, but it has two other things attached to it, I want to know really what's going on with those other two things.
Yes. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, stay with us tomorrow. We're going to be starting our discussion on State Issue 2, the law that was passed by the General Assembly in relation to state employees' collective bargaining, or public employees' collective bargaining. This is a very contentious issue. It's very hot. There are very passionate views on both sides of this issue. Hopefully, we're going to try to unpack the issue specifically tomorrow. And possibly on Thursday. I think that one's going to take 2 days at least as well. And hopefully come down to an understanding of the good, the bad, and yes, of course, the ugly of State Issue 2. Stay with us.
See you tomorrow. And now here's a message from the Institute on the Constitution's Michael Perutka with a constitutional moment.
Here's a statement that may offend you or some lawyer you know. There are virtually no attorneys in America today who are qualified to practice law. How can this be, you ask? Well, because every lawyer in America today went to law school, and because every law school in America teaches their students a way of thinking about the law that was designed specifically to prevent them from understanding the true source and nature and purpose and methodology of the law. They call it the case law method, and the case law method is a fraud and a lie. This method was conceived and introduced into legal education in the 1880s at Harvard Law School, and its designers hoped and intended that it would revolutionize how everyone in America viewed the whole subject of law. And that revolution has succeeded. Virtually everyone in America subscribes to this method of understanding, or should I say, misunderstanding of the law. This would include, of course, every judge on the Supreme Court and every judge on every court. And with very, very few exceptions, it would include almost all attorneys in America. So if what you hear from the media and from politicians makes no sense and sounds unreal, remember that most of them are lawyers and they were taught the case law method. This means not only that they don't know anything about law and government, but what's worse, they have been trained to believe and act on things that are specifically not true about law and government. You see, the schooling lawyers receive is designed to keep them from discovering the truth about law and where it comes from, and it works.